Good morning, everyone. It's February 23rd, 2005, and this is the House Ways and Means, or actually Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and we're beginning another session. We'll start by getting an update from Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today we are continuing with House Bill 5038, Seniors and People with Disabilities Cluster within the Department of Human Services. And we were going to continue with Kathy Cooper, who was going to finish up on performance measurements for this cluster, and then go to Mr. Taves, who was going to talk about the prioritized list for the seniors and people with disabilities cluster and present their 10% reduction list.
Okay, let's begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
And members of the committee, I'm Kathy Cooper from the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. I'd like to continue on. We were talking about our fourth performance measure yesterday, and just to highlight the information we were talking about, we were in a discussion about the average monthly wage for people with developmental disabilities who receive services through Senior and People with Disabilities. And as we noted, we had fallen short of this goal because of economic downturn, the competition for employment. But we did want to note that over 3,000 people with developmental disabilities have been able to find employment, and their average length of employment is 8.9 years, which I believe is a significant piece of information. We're on page 8 of the performance measures section of your book, and I wanted to go to some of the regional comparisons so that we could talk a little bit about the information that we have. This is information, again, as we have tried to explain to the committee, that sometimes it takes a while to get national and regional comparative data. But in this data, you will see for Oregon, we had over 4,000 people in paid employment, and you can see three other states' comparative information. The interesting part was 80% were in paid employment in Oregon. We had 38% of our people with developmental disabilities in regular work setting, integrated work settings, which is really our ultimate goal, to have them fully employed. And we had 42% of our people with developmental disabilities in some kind of a contracted sheltered workshop or a supported employment environment. We'll move on to key performance measure number 5. We have talked quite a bit in this committee about the percentage of seniors and people with disabilities who were re-abused within 12 months of the first substantiated abuse. Again, this performance measure, unlike other performance measures, the lower the percentage is, the better result. We really strive in all that we do to have and to protect victims of abuse. This performance measure was created in 2003, and our data for that period shows that people with developmental disabilities were re-abused 6% of the time, and for people with physical disabilities and seniors, the re-abuse was a 10% figure. Again, this supports our goal in the department of keeping people safe. We continue to pioneer efforts and strategies to try, through our rules and policies, to target abusive individuals and to prevent abuse in any of our settings or for people within the communities, since our abuse statutes cover all Oregonians that are seniors or people with physical disabilities. And so it's important that we are able to have protection for people, vulnerable people in our communities. We were not able to obtain any national comparisons in this performance measure. And the reason is because of the variation and change in the definitions across the nation, difference in statutes and rules, and definitions have prevented a national comparison. Yesterday, Cindy spent quite a bit of time with the committee talking about our Community Protective Services Program, and I think she highlighted for you of the 7,000 allegations, we had a 41% substantiation of those abuse complaints. Again, the number one abuse for seniors and people with physical disabilities was self-neglect. And the second most abuse type was financial exploitation. And I believe last week you heard from a coalition of agencies and organizations that are really trying to bring up awareness of financial exploitation among this population. And so while we strive in our performance measure to keep the number low, we believe through education and bringing up community awareness around things like financial exploitation, we really are doing a better job of protection of vulnerable citizens in the state of Oregon. We also wanted to note from yesterday's conversation that our home care workers are also part of our abuse information, and if we substantiate any abuse by a home care worker within our service delivery and our in-home program, they are removed from the list and they will not get another Medicaid referral to provide services within our system. So we thought that was an important clarifying point from yesterday's discussion. We also, Cindy, I think, took quite a bit of time talking about facility abuse yesterday, so I will not go over those numbers again. I did want to make sure we talked a little bit about people with developmental disabilities that are served by seniors and people with disabilities. The department had investigated over 1,500 alleged abuse. We had 32% of those complaints were substantiated. And the number one abuse was neglect, and the number two abuse was physical abuse. Yeah. The top reporters were actually...
Back to the home health care workers, what percentage have fallen in the category that you just described?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I do not have that number, but as we promised yesterday, we are compiling a series of reports and information, and we will add that, and we will give you that number. I do believe it's very low right now at this time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We also wanted to highlight that 47% of the abuse occurred in our adult group homes and 14% occurred in non-relative foster homes. We wanted to talk just very briefly with the committee outside of our key performance measures about some of our quality improvement and quality assurance activities that we have undertaken over the last 2 to 3 years within our organization. We have taken these actions in concert with our federal fund provider and partner, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And over the last several years, in 2001, they put forward a framework with protocols that states would use as they reviewed the quality of their home and community-based waivers. And in Oregon, we have 5 home and community-based waivers that serve seniors, people with physical and developmental disabilities. During the last year, one of the activities we did was really to help improve the quality of our field services and the quality of the information and the services that our case managers have provided. So during the last year, we had a group of state central office staff that are our field review team that went across the state. They did training and technical assistance for over 700 of our managers, first-line supervisors, and our case managers. And we drilled down on our staff's knowledge and quality that they do in assessments, in applying our service priority rules, in making sure that people are safe, making sure people make healthy choices, making sure that people that refuse service And they are at any type of risk, that we acknowledge that risk and we talk to them about that. And also we wanted to make sure that we had emergency plans for any of our clients that may find themselves at risk, and that we document a plan in case something happens. And that could be anything from their personal issues to things like fires, electrical outages for people on vents. That's what we want in their plan of care, so that we make sure that people that are at risk will be cared for during those times. Our field review team also went out and visited over 400 of our clients and did hands-on work with our case managers around our assessment tool, which was quite a discussion during the last legislative session when we found ourselves having to cut people from services based on our service priority rules. We also adopted in both of our sides of our organization our services to people with developmental disabilities, as well as our seniors and people with physical disabilities, a survey tool that is done at the local level. We started in 2001 by reviewing quality indicators that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services had asked us to do. And we now do this on a quarterly basis, where we randomly sample from a statewide list over 450 of our clients to make sure that we are meeting both our quality indicators as well as making sure we're providing the best services for our clients. We also in 2002 contracted with our county providers on our developmental disability sides to make sure that the waivered services were of high quality through our programs that are administered through our county organizations. And so they are doing the program monitoring and improvement for the programs for people with developmental disabilities. They, too, are doing a random sample to make sure that that quality indicator remains high. Throughout all of these efforts, we really have seen improvement in the quality of our programs. We have identified areas for technical assistance and for further training, and we are pursuing those aggressively at this time. If I could answer any questions of the committee, we put in some other quality assurance activities just to highlight some other activities we're doing.
Any questions?
I wanted to bring forward to you just...
Senator Bates?
Senator Bates.
I'm not sure this is the right group to ask this question to, so correct me if I'm in error. I've had a lot of concerns expressed to me by constituents that people are being dropped off of SPD and on the basis of not qualifying for level 11, 12, or 13. That's done sometimes rather arbitrarily. Sometimes the patient is not seen. It's done by phone or by letter. That some parts of the state have different standards than other parts of the state, and it's a lot of these, a lot of your survival levels are very, very subjective and have to be. By their nature, they're subjective. Is this the group of people who are trying to make those decisions? And if so, I'd like to hear a little bit more about some of the difficulties we've run into and some of the complaints that I've heard. And there's been cases in which senators had to step in and say, you made a mistake here, you got to reevaluate this, and in fact things were reversed. I know it's been very difficult for everyone involved in this, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you're trying to resolve those types of issues.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we are indeed the organization that's responsible for making sure that we have quality in those assessments. That is the effort we just spoke about. Over the last year or two, we really have taken our service priority rules and actually spent quality time trying to clarify our rules so that they would be more objective and not subjective, and that we could have a standard application across the state about the service priority rules. while we say that, we also know that every individual has different needs and presents themselves based on those needs and their conditions at any given time, as you well know. But we are striving to make sure that in our service priority rules that we're very clear about what substantial assistance means, what minimal assistance needs. And that's really the effort we did with all of our supervisors, managers, and case managers, was really to improve the quality of that assessment and of the application of the rule. And that's really why our field review team went out and did hands-on work on the assessment with clients. And we did that in over 400 cases to really make sure that when our case managers are applying our rules and our policies, they're doing it as accurately and as clearly as they can based on the information that's presented.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. If a client feels that they've not been evaluated properly, what is their recourse?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, any person that feels that the assessment that our organization has done is incorrect, they have the right to come in and ask for a reassessment based on new or presenting conditions or maybe information that was not presented during the evaluation. Sometimes family members, physicians, other community members that know the person very well also come in and help our case manager with maybe evidence that was not presented. We truly do have people that want to put the best face forward when our case managers and workers come. And in some instances, they present themselves in a manner that appears that they are able to take care of all of their activities of daily living. So sometimes family members, friends, other people that are in close connection with them can help us with some other evidence that will make us understand that maybe they're not eating properly, maybe they're not bathing, maybe they're not getting the quality care that they need. And then we're able to step in and actually change our decision.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, then ultimately they also can go to a contested case hearing and have the full due process that applies there. But let me say, I actually came down and spent a whole day with advocates from your area who were very concerned about this issue. And as they told their stories and we spent the day discussing this, I mean, much of this was in a time frame where there were notices coming from many parts of the department around the health plan, around eligibility for senior services, and it was such a confusing time for both our case managers, for our clients, and I think many of their complaints were absolutely legitimate. In fact, our staff has been meeting with Representative Buckley, too, to see if there are other parts of the assessment process where we can make assurances and make sure that the client understands, and we should not be doing things over the phone or impersonally. It should be in person. The person should fully understand both the assessment, the result, and what their rights to appeal are. The dilemma we still face is the entire assessment process was originally not designed as an eligibility tool to decide who is cut off and who's, we had to manipulate this tool in a sense as we started going into budget reductions. Originally it was really a case planning tool, but it is an electronic tool. We have tried to define the criteria much more specifically so there's less room for subjectivity, but that always enters in, and particularly as some of our clients, their conditions change on a fairly frequent basis.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that explanation. I think that if an actual contact is made with the client face-to-face, that would diffuse about 90% of this. A great deal of it occurred as a result of being done through the mail or over the phone. The case manager not actually seen the case, gone to the house, seen the client. I think that makes a huge difference. If that is now the policy, I think the law of this will be resolved in a way that both sides will feel more comfortable. And if that's your policy, and that's what I'm understanding, that's your basic policy now, I appreciate that change.
It is our policy.
Right.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to bring to your attention, yesterday we provided you with two documents we felt were really essentially more information around our performance and on national data. The first one is from the American Association of Retired Persons and their Public Policy Institute. It does quite a good job of describing Oregon's efforts at really still being number one in the nation around services to people under home and community-based waivers. It gives a little bit of national information on expenditures, and then it does some national comparisons with some maps that make it probably pretty easy to see how Oregon lines up. The second report, since we spent quite a bit of time talking about nursing facilities and how we try to move people from nursing facilities, I also wanted to bring to your attention our organization here in the state, the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, Bruce Goldberg's organization, and they just completed this report in December on the number of people and expenditures within our nursing facilities, and it's a very valuable piece of information as we go forward in our discussions. So with that, if there are any other questions, I'd be glad to respond to them.
I think we're done. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll move on now to the department-wide priorities and the subset of priorities for seniors and people with disabilities within those overall priorities, and then to the 10% reductions. So we'll be working again off the two spreadsheets that I think you've seen from the other clusters. And let me start first with the priority rankings. What I'd like to describe is the rankings the way we did them internal to seniors and people with disabilities. You'll see then along the left-hand column, because these are just the senior and disability rankings right here, but in the left-hand column there is a number which is the number of the ranking where it appeared in the department-wide document which you were presented with the first day. So. Again, we're just dealing with the rankings internal to the cluster, and then you can transpose that to the department-wide ranking by that number in the left column. Let me start with how we approach this task and the logic we attempted to come up with to make sense. We start with what is absolutely required in federal law. Federal law says that if a state takes any Medicaid at all for the health plan or for long-term care or for anything, it has to have some basic mandatory coverage. One of the things that is required in that mandatory coverage is nursing facility care. So that's the entire premise of the long-term care system from federal law. I think some of our advocates would still argue with that, and for good reason, but nonetheless, that is the foundation of the long-term care program in federal law. As we've also discussed in recent days, increasingly nursing facilities in Oregon and more so in other states are becoming almost an extension of the acute care system. They're less and less settings for long-term care and more settings for short-term stays, convalescence, post-hospitalization stays. And again, that we have to have a nursing facility program. The next three areas are really bunched together and are all the components of non-institutional care, which encompass our entire 24-hour system for all populations we serve, seniors, people with physical disabilities, and people with developmental disabilities as well. The second one, number 10, involves community facilities serving seniors and people with physical disabilities. That includes our ELFs, our assisted living facilities, our residential care facilities, adult foster care. And in the next column down, number 11, is DD, comprehensive services. That's all the 24-hour services for people with developmental disabilities in group homes and in foster care. The last is state-operated community programs, which is the small program for people that came out of Fairview that's run by state employees. The reason we rank 24-hour care second is that by the time either the family capacity is exhausted, a person has spent down, left their home, gone into 24-hour care, it is very, very difficult then to try to remove that person from 24-hour care. We looked at all kinds of 24-hour scenarios during last biennium when we were looking at potential budget reductions. And again, it's very difficult once that person is in 24-hour care. So that's why we rank it as the second highest priority. If we go to the second page.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wessler.
Quick question. In that non-institutional care, the wind down of Fairview, how many clients do you have in that category?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, sir. How many?
How many clients do you have in number 12?
About 5,000. No, that's state op. Oh, just. But in the entire DD comprehensive system, it's about 5,000 individuals. In just state operated, it's 141, the subset of that. Most of those individuals are in group homes. Part of them are in adult foster care.
So, priority number 12, we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Those are state operated.
141.
141, that's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, I think we moved overall out of Fairview over the course of 10 plus years about 12 or 1,300 clients. So it was that tiny subset of people with extraordinary needs that ended up in that particular program. If we go to page 2, priority number 29 at the top of the page in the department-wide ranking is the Oregon Supplemental Income Program, OSIP. We talked about that the other day. It's part of our maintenance of effort requirement. Next, then, we go to the multiple categories of in-home care. And I would stress again that in-home care is, again, one of Oregon's hallmarks in our long-term care system and is very important. But as we rank programs, again, people in 24-hour care, I think, would get protection first and before we looked at people being served in their own homes, even though if we cut off in-home care, many of those individuals ultimately would need 24-hour care as a result. The various categories there, number 40, is the in-home program, the client-employed provider program. That's the one represented by the home care workers. Number 41, in-home care, DD support services, is largely the Staley agreement where we provide support to individuals with developmental disabilities and their families.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
I'm not sure you can give us these numbers right now, but I'd like to get an idea of the number in this category and broken up by elderly, disabled, and who's being cared for by relative care in both those categories of elderly and disabled.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, I think there were a couple questions the other day on that, too, so we'll try to put that all together, and we can do that quite easily.
Okay, thank you.
Could you spend a few minutes more back on the bottom of page number 1? It's priority number 12. We just did, you know, the basic arithmetic. At 141 clients, at $79,541,000, comes out to roughly $282,000 a year per person. First of all, is that, are we doing the math correctly? Is that what we're looking at? And then also, could you tell us what is involved, what that includes?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's $280,000 a year. I mean, I can get you the exact number. I believe it's around $200,000 a year, but I'll get you the exact number. But it is a very, very high cost, and it's an extraordinarily high cost. Most of these individuals, by the time they left Fairview Training Center, were being served at even a higher cost than that. The individuals we're talking about here are people with extraordinary medical conditions, and the larger category are people with very, very significant behavior challenges, including dangerous behaviors. In some cases, they were not adjudicated, but they had proclivities to sexual offenses. It was a very, very high-profile group, and the decision we made as we closed Fairview was to provide very intense staffing. Many of these homes are, in fact, secure. They're not locked. These people are not on parole. They're not adjudicated or anything of that sort. But nonetheless, we staff 24 hours a day. For some individuals, we shadow them in the community with one or two staff at a time. It's a very high-profile program for a very small group of individuals.
Okay. Question?
Mr. Chairman, we're also within that program now. It's not only a continuing population, but it's also certain individuals we have that come in for a 90-day period because of a crisis in the community, and an existing community residential program cannot support them for whatever reason. And so it's part of our, since we don't have Fairview and we only have 45 beds left at Eastern Oregon Training Center, in many ways, if someone is civilly committed or at risk or presents a significant danger to themselves or their family, that's pretty much the amount of capacity we have.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
I was also trying to crunch the numbers just real quickly, too. I'm sure I've made a terrible mistake here, but correct me if I'm wrong. What's the total funds for this 141 people?
80 million.
On this list, $79 million, and we'll verify those numbers in the per-person cost.
What is roughly your figure on that?
Ours is roughly $282,060
per person.
And they said it's closer to 200,000.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, that's a biennial number.
No. Well, yeah, but
it's 282,000
is annually. 200,000 a year.
Right. Okay. Well, we will get you the exact number, Mr. Chairman.
I guess we're stunned. No, it's over $500,000 per biennium per person or per position. As you say, people are moving in and out. Is this something that other states are paying as well? I mean, is this a tremendous amount of resources, and so we're trying to come to understand if this is just the way it is.
Mr. Chairman, several comments. One, we keep this program very, very small for exactly this reason, because of its very high cost. By the time we closed Fairview Training Center and Oregon had been under a consent decree with the United States Department of Justice, I think for almost 15 years, we spent an enormous amount of time with lawyers and experts that combed through Fairview almost every day, making huge demands on the state. We increased our costs while Fairview was still open probably 6 or 7 times over, I don't know, over that period of time. When we finally closed Fairview, the costs per person per month, I think, were $22,000-$23,000 a month. So it was up in that, and that was the average cost, Mr. Chairman. So if you took the cost as an average at that amount at Fairview and then looked at individuals in this category that had one-to-one staffing or extraordinary supports, it would have been much, much higher than that. So we consciously made a decision. In the debate over the closure of Fairview, there were long discussions that we had both at the department and in the legislature over 2 biennia. We had major debates around this policy decision and whether we'd keep a piece of the institution open for certain individuals with very high-profile needs or whether we would develop community settings for them. And we made the latter choice, acknowledging that for that group we would have very, very high costs because of either security or intense medical needs. They needed very high-level supports. The question is, do other states pay rates in this neighborhood? Yes, many of them do, and many other states have similarly been through extensive federal litigation, institutional closures of this type. But again, we're not talking about a typical kind of person that we serve in a community. In most other states, they would either be in an institution with round-the-clock medical and all kinds of other support, or they would be in a very costly community program.
I guess this is important enough that we would really appreciate it if there could be some additional time spent giving us comparisons to other states. If this is best practices and most efficient practices, then so be it. But it's important for us to see that we are not alone in these kinds of numbers. Anytime you're pushing $300,000 a year per person, since things do go up, we would certainly like to know what other states are doing and how we compare.
Mr. Chairman, we'll try to get you some comparative information. The difficulty in comparison will be that in many other states, these people are still served in institutions. So it's not really an apple-to-apple comparison in terms of a community-to-community cost.
If they're being served in institutions and if the cost is substantially less, then it becomes a policy issue that has to be looked at, because we have a restricted amount of resources, and those resources that are being spent in this area are not being spent in other areas, and so we just need to periodically reconsider what we're doing. I'm not suggesting anything other than I'd like to know what is being done elsewhere, what the costs are, and I mean, this just so that we can have some comparison.
Mr. Chairman, we will do everything to get that to you. The only caveat, again, is in most states you can get the institutional costs that will be the average across the entire population that is served in an institution. But then if you try to break out a subset of people with the most extraordinary staffing and medical needs, it will be difficult to extrapolate that, I believe. If we can do that, we will do that, but it may be difficult to do that.
Okay. Representative Hanna, then Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess beyond comparative data to other states and where this typical person would be served, I would like to request, if the chairman would agree, that we could see individualized data from a select group within this panel of folks that are being served. Show us what the high end is, because if this is the average, somebody's got to be above that. And give us an example of the breakdown of cost for what it takes in medical care, what it takes for 24-hour care. Tell us how that breaks down, and then pick somebody out of the middle and somebody out of the low end, so we have a representative example of where these costs are for the folks that are in this facility.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Representative Hanna, we can do that. We also did a task group and a report last biennium. There were a lot of questions swirling around this program similarly because of its high cost, and so we did some reporting back to this committee, and I think to the substantive committees, I'm not sure, that did a lot of descriptors about the profile of these kind of individuals and the costs. I think we may have that data readily available, and we'll be happy to pull that together.
Thank you. Rip Hansen.
Well, very, very similar point. I would like to see the breakdown of the medical costs. If there's a lot of, like, kidney dialysis and high-end medical costs, this is very explainable. On the other hand, but to get it, or the way Representative Hanna had you break it down with the three patients and how their costs are split between security, medicine, and treatment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, more often it will be the staffing costs, not the medical costs. I mean, certainly there are high medical costs for some of these individuals, but the most expensive group is really the folks that require quite extraordinary levels of supervision and staffing, and that's where the big costs will be.
Okay. Senator Winters, and then Senator Westlam.
I was along the same line as Representative Hanna, the high end, the low end, but also some profiles so that you have clearly an understanding of what behavior and what you're talking about. You know, you mentioned the sexual abuser, but I understand that there's also some individuals who have even more severity than that, so that this committee has a knowledge of actually what you're talking about for those who were removed from Fairview, who were not adjudicated, but yet their high risk profile would have, had they been adjudicated, probably been someplace else. You know, I think it's well that this body knows just specifically what the characterizations of the individuals that you're talking about that are in the group home, and that would be most helpful, I think.
Senator Wesson.
Yeah, and as you're presenting that data that we've requested, I think it's important, incumbent upon us, to remember the historical circumstance in the closing of Fairview. I mean, it was a very controversial, it was court-ordered by the feds, and the conditions that produced this population under these circumstances had their own unique history. So if you could delve into that a little bit as well.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, we can... Let me say, however, I don't want to lead the committee on that somehow the costs went up substantially as we moved people out of Fairview into the community. For the vast majority, the costs were substantially less. So ultimately, the closure resulted in, I think, about a $50 million a biennium. I should be cautious in throwing out numbers, but in a substantial savings, which we then plowed back into community programs in the form of the waiting list that was sort of the seeds of the original Staley agreement, and other cost of living adjustments for providers and things of that sort, people on the waiting list. So overall, the costs went down dramatically. And we're talking about the very small subset of folks that in most states, again, would still be in institutions. We serve them in a different way, but at a high cost. But relative to the entire sort of package, it was it represented some substantial savings to the state.
Mr. Chair, it would probably be well if we had and I know you can do a projection of had we continued what we were doing in the past, what the cost would be now versus what it would have been versus what it is now, because I believe last session, previous sessions, that kind of information has been given to us, and it might be well to give it to us again.
Well, we have the costs of the Pendleton facility and the state hospital facility, which are locked down.
Yeah, Fairview, but we don't have the one for Fairview, which is the one that we're right. Really that has created a lot of the discussion, in which the court case, which the agreement that was reached with the feds was the one that was that we fought for 15 years.
But let me add, Mr. Chairman, the costs at Eastern Oregon Training Center, the Pendleton facility serving only 45 individuals with developmental disabilities, is approaching this cost as well. It is a very, very high cost. These particular type of facilities have been micromanaged and federally regulated and litigated to death with huge requirements for program and treatment that we don't transpose into community programs. So, again, even at Eastern, and for the most people left at Eastern, their acuity levels or complexity of need is much, much less than this group, and in fact, less than even some of the people that we placed out of Fairview. So, when you start doing cost comparisons of, again, the institutional type of service, it's not an apple to apple, but it gives a point of reference.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
One last comment. I don't really have an off to offer that Representative Hanna and Senator Westland didn't ask, because that's really, I think, the key of understanding the situation. But from my limited experience as a physician with this population, it's limited. You're really looking at one-to-one care most of the time for these people, and significant facilities to maintain them, and significant medical costs on top of that. And that's how I think you get to this huge figure every year for them. Most people, to put someone into that position as a one-to-one care provider, you're talking three people, eight-hour shifts, $50,000 a year. You're up to $150,000 a year right there. And then you have to pile on the rest of the needs of those people for medications and health care and hospitalizations at time, I'd imagine. So I'm beginning to get a perception of how you might get to this incredible figure per person, but I think the information that the representative Pan has asked for will give us a pretty clear picture of this. It's a shocking number, but when I think back through it, how we got here with this daily decision, I can understand a little bit more of those kind of numbers, but they are shocking numbers. Thank you.
Well, this daily decision, those that are subject to this daily decision are not, I mean, we're talking $800 a month plus the cost to impose that, and so this is a whole lot different.
These are the severe ones. Yeah. These are the very severe ones.
Okay. Right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, again, this population really wasn't part of the Staley agreement.
Sorry.
The whole Fairview decision, the closure, that policy decision preceded Staley, actually. But again, I think Senator Bates is right. That's not the profile for the typical community service pattern. We don't do one-to-one staffing in most programs across the state. This is, the select group, that final population that requires very heavy staffing. And you're absolutely right. If you do one-to-one staffing or even close to that over three shifts a day and then you do a posting factor, you get to a very high staff level and a very high cost.
Okay. Thank you. We're on page two.
Number 29. Mr. Chairman, is the Oregon Supplemental Income Program, OSIP. We talked about that the other day. That's the maintenance of effort with the Supplemental Security Income Program, where we contribute $20.40 annually for each individual. Number 40 and 41 represent the two parts of our in-home care program, both the client-employed provider program, on the senior and physical disability side, and then number 41, the support services for adults with developmental disabilities that are mostly in the Staley agreement. Again, we rank these lower than 24-hour care for the reasons that I described. Going on to the next page, number 51 is our Older American Act program. Then number 50, and again, that's exclusively federal funds. Number 52 is in-home care, but these are other parts of in-home care. It includes adult daycare, meals, transportation, and some other things for the in-home population. Number 53 is Oregon Project Independence, a very important program, but a general fund only for generally non-Medicaid eligible individuals. And last, ranked last, and ironic given this discussion, is Eastern Oregon Screening Center. And it's a little different on the senior and physical disability side. I said we have to have nursing facilities as a requirement, a mandatory requirement. We also have to have what's called an ICFMR, an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded under federal law, to have any programs under the home and community-based waiver. Eastern Oregon Training Center is our only remaining ICFMR. But given the clientele there, there is the potential that we could move them into the community and we could license one or two smaller programs as ICFMRs and still meet that federal requirement. That's why that's ranked as low as it is here, because there would be a replacement option for that population.
Mr. Brennan.
James, back on the state operated group homes, those do not count for the purposes of the waiver as an ICFMR.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Britton, no, we very consciously licensed them and funded them under the home and community-based waiver. Had we made them ICFMRs, and we actually had some advocacy groups and parents and to some extent the union that was arguing for that, but we felt that invited all kinds of federal scrutiny and potential litigation, in part because each of those 41 individuals, actually more than that, had literally been followed out the door of Fairview by federal lawyers and experts who were making all kinds of demands about their program. And we felt if we used the federal certification then for those programs on the community side, it was just inviting a continuing saga that we were hoping to end at that time.
And the number of clients and in the Eastern Oregon Training Centers, how many is that?
It's, Mr. Chairman, it's currently 45 individuals. Originally, when it was developed, it had a capacity of 90, but over the years, as the population has aged and new admissions have not come in, it's fallen to 45. Any other questions on the priority rankings?
Just one question, Mr. Chair. The types of people that go into these programs, are the numbers increasing, or with new medication, et cetera, we're catching some of these disorders early and therefore they don't progress to the point that they are now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, typically a person ends up in a facility more as a circumstance of their family than it does the complexity of their care. I mean, there's a correlation, but when we closed Fairview, for example, we actually showed profiles of identical people, matched pairs, with the same conditions, very severely disabled, requiring 24-hour care, turning, you know, incredible amounts of care that in some cases families had still chosen to do, whereas their absolute counterparts were in institutional care. So to the degree, and I think that was part of the premise of the Staley agreement, in the bargain we struck with the plaintiffs in that is that we would hold down the expansion of 24-hour care. And if you look at the charts we presented on the first or second day on the service trends, the residential, the 24-hour trend, is fairly stable. It goes up slightly, but we've managed to keep that quite stable while we've tried to expand significantly support directly to families and individuals to help empower them, provide them respite and other added care. And you see people with really extraordinary needs, including medically fragile children and ventilators, where you go into a family home and it almost looks like an ICU of a hospital. And so it really depends on kind of what that external circumstance, the support of the family, the church, the relatives and others, but I think over time the population will expand, and in the disability area we're facing what we're facing in the aging area. We now have a disability group that itself are a group of boomers. So now you take their disabilities and you start adding aging factors, and particularly for certain conditions like Down syndrome and others, we seem to see a lot of early dementia. So I think those numbers will bulge, and the 24-hour care needs will start to expand. And in as much as we have, I think, almost 1,000 people with severe disabilities living with parents over 60, 70, 80 years of age, obviously that will, family support is a good thing, but it's not ultimately the answer there.
Follow-up? Just, I think, what we had said, I think, yesterday, too, it's a point. We have a culture that families don't take care of each other. It's, you know, just a different society, even when we compare Americans with other countries. The fact that we outcast so many of our own. Now, true, if they're truly, truly very disabled, they do need help. But again, it's a cultural issue, and I feel strongly that I wish that we could do something that, and I think we are in helping in-home care, but somehow instill that, yes, life isn't fair, but it isn't fair for a lot for everybody in their own unique way. And I just hate to see the outcast families, just those that take a lot of care, are families don't want to deal with them for some reason.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I couldn't agree more, but in many cases it wasn't families that started shirking their duty. It's what we, the professionals, and the social services system actually created in the developmental disabilities arena through the 40s and 50s and even in the 60s. We as professionals, the physicians, everybody said, this is the best thing. Institutionalize your child. And so we created that sort of sense that you don't have to provide care. And now we're making up for lots of lost time, and our emphasis now is family support and in-home supports and not institutional care. But again, I wouldn't in many cases fault families. I'd fault what we've sort of perpetuated on families, quite frankly.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
And I'd have to echo Mr. Tatum, because I was around when people first and when there was the movement to say, yes, we can function outside of the institution. And out of that, if I recall, Dr. Jean Black, and that was back in the 70s, that talked about we needed to have the DD population inside of our communities. We needed to begin to downsize care. We needed to do all these things. We needed to do integration. And I can still remember a major event that happened at, I believe it was the Hilton, one of the big hotels downtown. And it was probably if you could have seen the sight of all of these individuals who supposedly were so severely handicapped and who doctors and others had said they had to be in Fairview, that you saw them on stage taking control of their lives. Senator, Dr. Tafe is correct. It was the professional industry itself that said institution was best, and then we moved across this country to pattern and model after a lot of work that had been done in the Scandinavian countries. The one thing that we didn't do at the time, if I recall my history correctly, is that we didn't do the housing planning and we didn't do some of the other planning of how we were going to integrate all of these individuals into various levels inside of our community. I just had to add that little historic perspective because it's a long history of working to try to integrate this population back into our community. So,
Senator Bates.
I'll add a quick historic perspective, too, if I could. In the 20s and 30s and 40s and even in the 50s, many families felt that when you had a disabled person in your family that it was a blot on the family, and they would place those people into institutions. Even today, we're finding brothers and sisters who find out they have a brother and sister they did not know about. It's in an institution. Mom or dad dies, and they find the will or other areas that in fact, they have a brother or sister they didn't even know about sometimes. So we've had a change also in how families perceive these situations, and that needs to be recognized. I think that's what you're talking about to a great degree. The other thing you touched on is that many of these disabled people are living a great deal longer than they used to. We take better care of them now. We do not treat them as second-class citizens. We treat them appropriately and properly, and so they're going to live longer. And that's going to be another issue we're going to have to deal with as these people age and have disabilities and still need to be taken care of. One of the things I'm beginning to see, I believe, and this goes back to family stepping up, is I'm beginning to see brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews stepping up and saying, we're going to take care of Uncle Ben, or I'm going to take care of my brother at home as long as I get some support from the state. And I think we're seeing more and more of that. Maybe you can confirm or deny that for me. And as these people are staying in our communities and we're more aware of them, other family members other than just the mother and father are now involved in the care of these individuals as they age.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, that's absolutely correct. And still, when you look across all care ages and groups, the vast majority of care in this country is still provided by family. So it's only a subset of folks that we provide for care out of the home. And I think to the degree that we reinforce that policy decision by saying we're going to support families and we're going to support caregivers in those natural settings, and that's really our emphasis, that we will mitigate the effects of at least partially mitigate the effects of the aging demographic. But it's an important policy shift.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to share this story. My sister born in 43 was born completely deaf. And back then, you sent your little child to the school for the deaf, you know, the state, and it was institutional care. And my parents didn't agree with that, and maybe there were a lot of other parents too, but they worked so hard to they actually founded the Tucker Max and Oral School, and you know, said, hey, this person can be mainstream, so to speak, and live in society. And then in 7th and 8th grade, my sister went with me, even though she was 2 years older, to school with me. And that's why I sometimes have an issue with institutionalization, because those who grow up in an institution are so different than those that grow up in a family. And if we want people to fit into society, it's extremely important for them to have a home life. And that's where I'm coming from, where I feel that families really need to take care of their own, because I, from experience, see such a difference.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, shall I move on to the 10% reductions?
I think we should.
Mr. Chairman, if I could give a little bit of context to these reductions and how we got here, because I think you were raising legitimate questions on the very first day when the department-wide reductions were presented in terms of issues that seemed counterintuitive to other policy directions and issues that may invite lawsuits and other things. When we looked at budget control starting last biennium and then flowing into this biennium, we've tried to identify every area where we will not run afoul of federal law or regulations, or we will not automatically invite litigation, and still try to preserve the, sort of the basic tenets of Oregon's long-term care system. So when we started the reductions last biennium, we cut levels, we cut OPI, we cut general assistance, we froze enrollments to STALEY, we didn't grant cost of living adjustments, we did all the things that are still important but kind of at the edges of the core 24-hour and in-home system. When we looked at, and we'll cover that in phase two, so I won't go into any detail here, but when we looked at budget controls and reductions for this current biennium, we started out with several things that sort of put us into a box at the get-go. Number one, we had tried last biennium to look at reducing the income levels from 300% of SSI to 250% or something like that as a very clear, easy to understand objective standard for who gets in and who doesn't. We have, after lots of research, confirmed over and over again, we can't do that because of a phenomena called the income cap trust, where essentially people setting up an income cap trust can buy their way into eligibility. So we abandoned that. We looked at other issues in terms of level cuts again. When we cut levels originally, 11 through 17 last biennium, the legislature at the end then restored 12 and 13. We were very conscious at that time, and the federal government had told us over and over again not to come back with more changes in the levels. We had gone back and forth suggesting to add levels, take levels back, and they said you can't consistently change your mind on basic eligibility. So when we restored 12 and 13, they said that's it. Those levels have to remain eligible. We will not approve another change proposal to the federal government to cut levels. And then, of course, we had some other things that happened last biennium, the nursing facility tax, which put into statute the formula whereby we calculate the rates for nursing homes, and we had collective bargaining for the home care workers. So increasingly, the different options or choices we have where we can insert budget controls or reductions are becoming increasingly limited. That's part of what drove us to the issues that we'll cover in phase two in our budget, and that's what drives us to the list in this 10% reduction below the governor's recommended budget. So just a little bit of context why some of the things are here. Just going through the items, we have tried to avoid cutting rates in community programs for all the obvious reasons, the stability, the impact that has on wages for direct care staff, but getting in at the 10% below governor's recommended budget, we do not believe we could avoid rate reductions. So you see a series of rate reductions. First, the 5% reduction in the nursing facility rate. That would require a statute change. It would require a state plan amendment to the federal government. It would reduce the anticipated rate from about $157 a day to about $149 a day in nursing facilities. Looking at the priorities again, number 9, number 11, those are reductions in community 24-hour rates on both the senior and physical disability side of 3% and 2.5% for programs serving people with developmental disabilities. That comes on top of cost of living adjustments that have not been awarded since 2001. And those programs are struggling already.
Next question. Are these programs the programs that also have kind of a state-operated equivalent? In other words, I realized I'm getting talked to by a lot of people about different things. And one thing that was discussed was that there are community-based programs that are also like long-term care facilities that also have state-based facilities that are similar, except that the state-based ones have continued to get increases in their rates, but the ones that are community that are doing the same thing are not, or have not been getting these increases. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, certainly, Mr. Chairman, in the last biennium, we froze wages and step increases for all state employees, and we didn't grant a cost of living adjustment for all of our community programs, so we kind of did that across the board. I think historically community programs will tell you that the relative rate structure in community programs compared to state workers in Oregon State Hospital, Eastern Oregon Training Center, state-operated community homes, all of those is higher, particularly when you add the benefits and PERS and things of that sort, and that, I think, is probably the source of the discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, in number 13, other funds, part of the exercise we did here was a 10% reduction across all fund sources. So it includes general funds, other funds, and federal funds. So you'll see some other or federal funds reductions here that we would not, certainly not propose, but to get to that target, it's here. So we would reduce what local governments provide us in terms of local match that they put up that we then match under the Medicaid program to enhance case management or do other kinds of community activities. So that's why you see number 13 there. Number 14 would discontinue health insurance and workers' comp for home care workers. Obviously, that's a collective bargaining issue, and this is an interest arbitration group. So we would have to return to the bargaining table on that. Number 17 is similar to number 13. Again, to get to our other fund target, we would reduce local match that local governments offer.
Okay. Small, please, Representative Hanna.
On number 14, how many workers are covered in that group?
13,000. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the next page, number 29 would eliminate the Staley Agreement, which is a fairly large general fund and other and federal fund program. Number 37 would eliminate intensive in-home services for children. And again, you're seeing a lot of reductions in in-home kinds of programs to try to preserve 24-hour care whenever possible. This is known mostly as the medically fragile children's program of children that are ventilator dependent or have severe autism and reside with their families. Number 38, we delayed the inflationary increase, the cost of living adjustment to January. This would further delay that cost of living adjustment for all of our providers till July of 06. And number 42 is finally we'd eliminate levels for 12 and 13, which we've told the federal government we won't do, but again, to get to the 10% below governor's rec, that's where we ended up. So I'll be happy to answer any
questions. Representative Hanna.
I just want to follow up again on 14. I want to understand this. The total of the just shy of $67 million, is that, are the 13,000 workers that you speak of all covered for that price with health insurance?
Yes.
You want to?
No, all the workers,
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna. Health insurance covers those who work 88 hours a month or more, and all workers are covered by workers' compensation, both those above and below 88 hours.
I was going to ask you who your carrier was. That was cheap insurance. Okay, let me ask the question over. How many of those workers are covered by health insurance?
35, Mr. Chairman, 3,500 of the 13,000 who work 88 hours a month or more. And then again, all 13,000 under workers' compensation.
And the health insurance is PEB? Or is it a separate negotiated contract?
You want to talk? Let me invite Julia Huddleston, who headed up many of our negotiations on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Julia Huddleston with Seniors and People with Disabilities. The health insurance third-party administrator, Chair Richardson, is actually the Home Care Workers Union Benefits Board. And they've entered into contracts with ODS and with Kaiser for benefits of these eligible employees.
Okay, so how does that work if it's statewide and the workers are not in the area where Kaiser...
If they're not in Kaiser, Chair Richardson, the default is ODS.
Okay, thank you.
May I follow up as long as we're here? We started to talk about this the other day, but the workers' comp, what rate class do they work under? Are there multiple classes, or are they under a specific class, and what is their mod rating?
Chair Richardson, Representative Hanna, I don't know the specific class, but we can certainly get that to you. There is a single class. The carrier is the State Accident Insurance Fund, SAFE. The initial premise, the plan was costed in as a state retro premium plan with a 10-year claim tail. And we would be happy to provide you with information on more specifics.
Yeah, not only the class, but their mod rating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. What else do we discuss today?
That's it.
Any other comments, questions before we end this meeting early? We're not going to be having a meeting tomorrow. We're ahead of schedule. Are there closing remarks or comments that you'd like to make before we adjourn?
Mr. Chairman, we're pleased to have been here. We are working on all the questions and data, and I think intend to have most of it at least by the end of the week, if we possibly can.
It's very helpful to get it before we get too deep into the next segment, so it does help. And we'll continue studying. You've given us great information. We appreciate the time and effort that all of you have expended in providing this cluster report. With that, we'll have a comment from Senator Westland.
Well, just a request. James, when you're getting us the information, the answer to those questions, if it has to come piecemeal, give us the information you've got, but also in that data sheet, let us know the questions that are yet to be answered.
Okay.
Chairman, we'll do that.
Look forward to receiving it. Thank you. Thank you. That will be adjourned.